Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, a new picture of the magnetic fields around the Milky Way's enormous black hole help show how it's eating.
Material falls in towards the black hole, and at the last second, some of it doesn't cross the event horizon and gets ejected out at just enormous speed. And that material that gets shot out rules the fates of the host galaxies and, in fact, host galaxy clusters.
And who you calling a bird brain? Understanding how tiny chickadees accomplish the remarkable task of remembering where they've stashed their food.
It's estimated that throughout the woods, you know, a chickadee could have tens of thousands of caches that they're relying on and keeping track of.
Plus, why the chicken crossed the Silk Road, what you're saying when you talk with your hands, and LED lighting is bright, efficient, and maybe a problem. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. At the center of our galaxy, a monstrous, supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star twists and turns and spins and gobbles matter into its mighty maw. It's 26,000 light years away, so we're not too concerned about our planet getting hoovered into its depths, but it's close enough that astronomers can study the flow of matter around all those twists and turns. And now, thanks to a groundbreaking new image captured by the Event Horizon Telescope, we're able to see how this monster moves in a new light. Dr. Avery Broderick is a professor at the University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and part of the Event Horizon team. Dr. Broderick, welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you, Bob. It's a great pleasure to be here.
First of all, describe this new image of Sagittarius A for us. What's it look like?
Right. So this new image looks very much like the one that was published a couple years ago. It's a shadow wreathed in flame. Right. We see this bright emission surrounding the event horizon. What's been added here are these striations, are these lines that indicate the direction of polarization. And these lines aren't just straight. It's not just up and down or left and right, but they kind of spiral around, twist around the black hole, and betray this ordered polarization pattern all the way around the ring.
Well, it is quite a remarkable image. When I looked at it, it looked kind of like hair that had been swirled around in some exotic haircut, or something going down a toilet bowl. I mean, it's a vortex, right?
Well, that's very astute. In fact, it is both of these things. Astronomical black holes have stuff around them. There's matter that is accreting. And that matter imbues, you could think of it as a toupee, right? It's a hairstyle being placed on the black hole. And those striations, those polarization patterns, are telling us something about a key component of that additional material, the structure of magnetic fields going around the black hole.
So this image is material that's swirling around the black hole before it falls into the hole, not the hole itself.
That's correct. Yeah, the black hole itself is, a perfect camouflage artist, you know, the winner of every hide-and-seek game. We can't see it directly. But what we do see is that extremely hot plasma that has fallen headlong towards it just before the last plunge.
Well, what was it that you were looking for with this new image?
Well, so when we see polarization in astronomy, you can think of that as being synonymous with magnetic fields. Almost all of the radio polarization, the EHT observes in high-frequency radio waves. Almost all radio emission across the sky is a process called synchrotron emission. These are very excited electrons, very energetic electrons gyrating around magnetic field lines. And so they will emit light, they'll emit radio waves that are polarized perpendicular to the field line. So if you can map out the polarization, you can map out the magnetic fields right around the black hole.
Now, when you're talking about polarized light, is that similar to the polarized sunglasses you can get where the light is oriented in one direction?
It is exactly the same. It's kind of funny. We live in a polarized world. You look up at the sky. The sky, anyone who has polarized sunglasses should try this. Hopefully not while they're driving. You look up at the sky and you'll see it's in fact polarized in a direction relative to the sun. But it's exactly the same idea, this directionality of light that shows up in our polarized sunglasses.
So when you saw this structure around the black hole, was that what you expected?
You know, so this is a wonderful question. We actually have a variety of expectations. One of them is what we saw. So that's nice. It's nice when the theory works out. I am a theorist still, and I know that because when the theory works, that's when the bell in my heart goes off. But we had many theories that predict something different. And that's because these black hole these magnetic fields have a critical role to play in driving that material in towards the event horizon of the black hole. And the structure of those magnetic fields then are telling us something about how that drama plays out. And some, you know, in some cases, in some simulations, in some models, we ought not to have seen a great deal of polarized emission. The fields would be too tangled up. So it was a relief to see that any of the models were right, and it was actually wonderful to see that, in fact, these magnetic fields do play this extremely important role that we expected them to play in black holes growing.
So the magnetic fields are acting like a giant funnel directing material in towards the center.
Well, so that's one way to think about it, but I think the way we normally think about it is they are like rubber bands that are connecting different pieces of the gas. I mean, I don't know about you, but I woke up this morning quite relieved that the Earth had not yet accreted into the sun, followed straight into the sun. And the reason for that is angular momentum conservation. And the same thing happens around black holes. And so you need some way of tugging on material to force it onto successively smaller orbits. And the magnetic fields, in some sense, are these stretchy bands that connect different parts of that plasma and allow the outer parts to tug on the inner parts and drive it inwards.
So what's generating these magnetic fields?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about this, is that what generates the magnetic fields is the plasma itself. It brings its own mechanism for ultimately being gobbled up by the black hole. It's the electrical currents within the plasma itself that drive or create the magnetic fields that force the plasma to accrete further onto the black hole.
So what can these images of the magnetic field around our black hole at the center of our galaxy tell us about how it works?
Well, so it's this question of how do black holes, how do they grow? How do they go from being smaller black holes to bigger black holes? The one at the center of our galaxy is 4 million solar masses. The one at the center of M87 is almost 7 billion solar masses. So how does one grow from one size to the other? But also, black holes aren't bystanders. They're movers and shakers in the universe. And somehow they play this magic trick where material falls in towards the black hole. And at the last second, some of it doesn't cross the event horizon and gets ejected out at just enormous speed. And that material that gets shot out rules the fates of the host galaxies and, in fact, host galaxy clusters. And so understanding this magic trick that black holes play at that last instant is critical to making sense of the night sky.
Now, this is the second dramatic image of a black hole you've talked to us about after the famous event horizon picture from 2019. What's next?
So that's a wonderful question. The EHT has opened a window, and we are busily peering through it. And we are still looking at the 2017 data set. But that's changing. In fact, earlier this year, we published the first image from the 2018 campaign, and we have campaigns in subsequent years as well. So we're starting to look at black holes not just in the moment, but how they change over long periods of time, in many cases over years. There's also this effort to expand the Event Horizon Telescope. It's already expanded from 8 stations to 11 stations, but there's a plan, the next generation Event Horizon Telescope, that will expand it by another 10 up to 20 stations. And with that instrument, we could map these magnetic fields. We could map this plasma flow literally from the event horizon to the stars.
Dr. Broderick, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Dr. Avery Broderick is a professor at the University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics.
The black-capped chickadee is one of the most common birds in Canada. It has an impressive memory where food is concerned, stockpiling reserves and recalling specific hiding places up to 28 days later. The chickadee feeds on...
The ability of chickadees to remember where their stashes of food are is almost uncanny. It's like they've got an internal treasure map with X's marking the spot. It's an ability I suspect many humans envy. I mean, where are my keys? Well, a new study has investigated just how chickadees' brains encode their treasure maps. It turns out they create a very specific type of memory that researchers are comparing to a barcode that links information about their cache and its location. Dr. Salman Shteh is the study's lead researcher. He's a postdoctoral research scientist in neuroscience at Columbia University's Zuckerman Institute in New York City. Hello and welcome to our program.
Hi, I'm really excited to be here.
First of all, tell me about this chickadee caching behavior. How does it normally work in the wild?
Oh, it's really fascinating. So chickadees will, they're oftentimes foraging for food, and sometimes rather than eating food that they find right away, they'll decide to cache it. So they'll, say, take up something like a sunflower seed and fly off to a different part of the woods and hide that individual seed in a tree somewhere, like behind some peeling tree bark. And when they do that, they form a memory of what they hit so that later, the next day or the next week, when they're hungry and they can't find food, they can use that memory and return to the site where they hid the food previously to eat. So it's really a matter of life or death for these birds, remembering where they hide their things.
Now, I understand the chickadees don't migrate, so I guess this would be a handy habit to have if they want to survive the winter.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thought of sort of how this behavior has evolved, is that rather than migrating south in order to find food in warmer climates, they'll stick it out in these cold climates through the winter. And of course, there's just not a lot of food to find there. So they've evolved this behavior of caching, hiding food, and the memory to support that.
How many caches might a chickadee have?
Yeah, so it's estimated that throughout the woods, you know, a chickadee could have tens of thousands of caches that they're relying on and keeping track of.
Tens of thousands? That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And, when people first saw this behavior, they kind of, you know, because a chickadee is quite a small bird and people may have downplayed their intelligence and sort of just assumed, oh, there's no way they really know what they're doing. There's no way they really keep track of everything they're hiding. But research has really borne out that they really have a sort of centimeter scale precision in remembering, you know, hundreds, thousands of items. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, how did you investigate how the chickadees store where all the X's are in the maps of their brains?
So we create artificial environments in the laboratory, which mimic kinds of things like peeling tree bark, where a chickadee will want to hide seeds. And we implant a small probe, which can record the activity of individual neurons in the hippocampus. And then we use a lot of video cameras and other sort of tracking to automatically detect where the bird is and when it caches and when it retrieves seeds. And then we can relate the behavior that it's doing to the firing patterns of neurons in the hippocampus of the bird.
Well, paint a picture for the setup for me. What was your lab containment like?
Yeah, so there's, we call it an arena, and there's 128 different sites. And each site is the same, but in a different location, different direction. And each site has a little perch that the bird can land at. It's actually a wooden dowel. And then in front of each perch, there's a hole, a little cutout in the floor. And there's this rubber flap that's on top of it that the chickadee can peel back and stuff a seed inside to hide it. And after it does that, the rubber flap sort of, you know, snaps back down and makes it so that you can't see inside whatever was hidden in that cutout.
Oh, I see. So your rubber flap is acting like maybe a piece of tree bark that the bird would hide its seeds in.
Yeah, exactly. So now after the bird is cached, it can look around the arena and it doesn't see any seeds. They're all obscured from its vision.
Boy. So what did you see going on in the bird's brain while it was caching its food supply?
Previous research had shown that birds that cache food, like the chickadee, they have a hippocampus and they need this hippocampus in order to remember where they've hidden their cached food. And so when the bird made a cache, the hippocampus entered this different kind of state of activity. And specifically, this pattern of activity was kind of unique for each individual cache the bird made. That's what we were calling the barcode.
Why are you calling it a barcode?
We're calling it a barcode because it seems like just a random pattern, but it's actually really specific for that cache. So for example, when the bird is going to go and retrieve that seed later, that same pattern of activity that initially seemed random during the cache, it's reactivated again later when the bird retrieves that seed.
So how different is this barcode signal compared to what was happening before and after the bird was caching?
Yeah. So the hippocampus is really famous for containing these neurons called place cells. And these place cells represent where an animal is. And now this has been seen in many different animals, including mammals and also recently in birds. And so when the bird was moving around before it made its cache, we saw this place cell activity that sort of represented where in the environment the bird was. And then when the bird made a cache, this is this, you know, just for a very brief moment in time, almost like a little 1 second blip in the signal, we saw this hippocampus flip into this different state where we saw that barcode activity. And so it's really different because you could imagine place activity every time the bird returns to the same part of the environment, you get a similar place activity. But the barcode, on the other hand, was really unique for each cache. And so it signaled not just where the animal was, but more like a single event, like something that happens once in the animal's life.
Boy. So what's that say to you then about how the chickadee is remembering where its caches are?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really beautiful match to the impressive memory that they have, right? Because you're forming so many memories and you have to keep them all distinct from each other. You don't want to blur them into each other. And so we think that that pattern maybe becomes associated or, you know, connected with the activity of these place cells that represent a location. And so together, they sort of give you the map and the X on the map.
So how widely do you think this type of specific encoding in the brain may apply to other species for other types of memories?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We don't know the answer to it just now, but we think it might be more general beyond just chickadees and potentially even be similar to what happens in the human brain. So there are some findings in humans that are consistent with barcodes being present in the human hippocampus too. But it's been hard to look for this kind of signal because oftentimes it's very hard to tell when an animal forms a memory. You know, caching is really distinct in that exactly when the bird hides a seed, it's just a 1 second long event and you know an animal right then formed a memory of what it hid. And so we think that these signals may just have been missed in some previous studies. But now that researchers have a better idea of what to look for, they may start finding them in a lot of different animals, including humans.
Well, I hope they find it in my brain so I can keep track of those keys.
Yeah, I hope so.
Dr. Steth, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Salman Steth is a postdoctoral research scientist in neuroscience at Columbia University. Regardless of culture, our communication with spoken language is not limited to sound. We move our bodies to help us better make our point or tell our story. Sometimes it's very subtle, like a tilt of the head. Other times it's more dramatic, like banging our fists on the table. And one stereotype that exists in popular culture is that Italians tend to gesture emphatically as they speak. But do people from Italy truly talk with their hands more than speakers of other languages? Researchers Maria Graziano and Marianne Goldberg tested this assumption in a new study. They watched two groups of people as they told the same story in either Italian or Swedish to a friend and recorded their movements. Maria Graziano is an associate professor at Lund University in Sweden. Dr. Graziano, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Now, what were the people in your study actually describing?
Well, they were watching a cartoon, and then they were telling the story that they have seen in the cartoon to a friend who had not seen the cartoon.
What was the cartoon about?
It is a cartoon of the Pingu series, so it's a series for children, and this is so it's very easy to retell. And the reason for choosing this is that it's a wordless cartoon, so the speakers do not have an input from the source when they tell the story, so they are free to tell the story as they like.
Oh, I see. So they just had to describe the action as it goes on. So how then did the Italians and the Swedes use gestures as they were telling this story?
Yeah, well, Marianne Gulberg and I, my colleague, we wanted to test this stereotypical idea about Italians gesturing more than Swedes. And what we find, which is the most interesting result of our study, is that in the two groups, people gesture differently. So it's really not about the frequency of the gesture that is the most relevant result here. And it is true that it comes out that Italians gesture more than Swedes. But there is a difference in the kind of gestures that in the two languages people use.
Okay, well, can you give me some examples of the differences in the way they were using their gestures?
Yeah, so the main difference is that Swedish tend to use more representational gestures to represent events and actions happening in the story, or shapes or dimensions of the objects they talk about. So, for example, when they say, and then there is a Christmas tree, a Swede will produce a gesture that represents a triangular shape, which is an iconic way to represent a Christmas tree. Italians, instead, tend to use gestures that are used to comment on the story, present new parts of the story to the listener. So, with the same utterance, and then there is a Christmas tree, an Italian will produce a gesture that is typically produced with both hands that are open, and they are brought with the palm up with a slight rotation with the wrist, and they are moved a little bit back downwards and in the area of the listener. So, this is a way to present information to the listener, rather than representing information. So in a way, it's like the Swedish have a more concrete way to talk about the story, representing actions that have happened. And the Italians have a more, if you like, an abstract way. They concern the way in which the story is constructed. So the way in which we are interpreting this difference is that in the two groups, there is a different way of using rhetorical styles. So there is a different way of conceptualizing the story, which again is a little bit more concrete in Swedish and more abstract in Italian.
I see. Now, did the stories that the people tell, did they differ in any way?
No, and that's a very important point here, because this difference that we notice in the conceptualization of the story comes, visible only if we look at gesture. We did an analysis of the structural properties of the narration, and in the spoken part is very similar in the two groups. So it's through the gesture that we see that the story is conceived in a different way.
Did the gesturing that the people were doing, did that influence the spoken story?
No, I will not say so. If anything, it's really the other way around. It's more like how we produce the part of the story and what we want to highlight in the part of the story that influence which kind of gesture we produce.
So the gestures actually were just reflecting a style of storytelling.
Yes, that's what we think.
Were you surprised by those findings?
Well, yes, a bit, because we didn't expect this difference, in terms of the different kind of gestures. So that's why for us, this is really the most interesting result, much more than the fact that we find a high frequency of gesture in Italian.
Mm-hmm. In a way, it's like the gestures are different languages, because they were speaking different languages, so their gestures were different languages, but the story was still the same.
Yeah, indeed. We can't really say that gesture is a language, because we do have sign languages that are really languages, and they use the same medium, which is the hands. But we know that the kind of language that we use can influence gesture production.
Do you think the results would be different if the participants were describing something more complex?
Yeah, that can be. And this is one of the things that really we would like to do, is to have more data with more participants and also talking about different kind of things. It's very likely that if we talk about, let's say, for example, describing a route or describing objects or argumenting for something, then we have different kind of gestures. And this can be true in both languages.
So what do you plan on studying next?
Yeah, that's what we would like to enlarge this study with more participants, possibly more languages. That will be really interesting because we don't know what the results will be if we compare other languages. And again, in more different kind of discourse. And also, for example, we would like to take into consideration the familiarity with the listener. In this case, the speaker knew the listener, so they are familiar with him, with them. But we don't know if the production both speaks in the speech and in gesture with a change of level of familiarity. Mm.
What made you look at hand gestures in particular in this study as opposed to other things like head nodding or the other kinds of nonverbal communication that we give to each other all the time?
Yeah, I mean, both my colleague and I, we work mostly with hand gestures. I mean, we have been working for many, many years, the two of us, on gestural production. So that's why we concentrate on gesture. But it is very true. All the rest of multimodal behavior, like head movements and eyebrows movements, the posture, the distance between participants, all of these are aspects that are very interesting and very important. But you cannot analyze everything in one go.
Just one last thing I have to ask you since we're on the radio. Have you been using your hands as you talk throughout this conversation?
Of course, as you have, I guess.
Dr. Graziano, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Maria Graziano is an associate professor at Lund University in Sweden.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, host of The Big Story. For 6 years now, we've been telling one story a day, every one of them about something that matters to Canadians. This spring, though, we're going deeper. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt, the inside story of Ontario's Greenbelt scandal. From political games to stag and doe parties, endangered species, RCMP investigations, and Las Vegas massages, you will hear the full story. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt. New episodes every Monday, and you can get them all by following The Big Story wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, we're lighting up the night with bright, efficient LED lighting, but there's a dark side to this we may be missing.
Almost every week, people are reporting the impacts of artificial lighting on yet another biological system has been discovered.
We may never know what came first, the chicken or the egg. But new research is shedding some light on the question of which was more important for the people who domesticated the ubiquitous bird. It might surprise you to know that compared to other farm animals like sheep or pigs, chickens were domesticated fairly recently. And new research from an international team of scientists suggests that the chicken's egg-laying abilities played a big role in humans keeping them around. Robert Spengler was one of the scientists working on this study. He's the leader of the Domestication and Anthropogenic Evolution Research Group at the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology in Germany. Dr. Spengler, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me here.
First of all, can you tell me more about what we know about when and where chickens were domesticated?
Yeah, so they definitely were domesticated in Southeast Asia. That's the range of the wild jungle fowl. And the process and timing of their domestication has long been a topic of dispute. I think it's looking like they're more recently domesticated than previously thought. So the original domestication probably taking place something like 5,500 years ago, and they're spread out of Southeast Asia is the topic that my team is particularly interested in. And we have evidence now showing that they're well spread across Central Asia and into the Eastern Mediterranean by 2,500 years ago.
Well, were the chickens that people were domesticating thousands of years ago like the ones you see on farms today?
No, definitely not. The current chicken is a product of directed breeding and probably only about 100 years old. They're rapid growing and they're large egg-laying breeds today. The older versions of chickens were quite different. And depending how far back in time you go, they, of course, would have been closer to the wild jungle fowls. And the wild jungle fowl only lays about 6 eggs a year in one brood. So the ancestor of the chicken could not have been raised for egg laying. It simply would not have produced enough eggs to maintain the population and also feed the humans raising them with eggs.
Now, why are there gaps in the domestication history of chickens?
Yeah, there's a couple answers to that. One is that chicken bones simply do not preserve well. They're very fragile. They break down in the soil well. So archaeologically, they tend to be very much underrepresented in relationship to other domesticated animals like sheep, goat, or horses. And the other answer is identification. So chickens, morphologically, using traditional archaeological methods, they're hard to differentiate from other large birds that are about the size of a chicken. In this way, they tend to be misidentified.
Well, tell me about your study. How did you go about finding eggshells and determining that they were from chickens?
Yeah, so I'm actually an archaeobotanist. So most of my work consists of looking at small fragments of plants in archaeological sites. And I spent a lot of time at a microscope sifting through sediment samples. Starting about 8 years ago, working in Central Asia, I started to note very small fragments of eggshells. And most of these are roughly 2 millimeters in diameter. So they're things that most archaeologists would simply overlook. And rather than discarding them, I started to collect them as I was going through these samples. And over time, my team has collected tens of thousands of these small fragments from more than 13 different archaeological sites spanning roughly 3,500 years.
Well, how did you know that these eggshell fragments that you had came from chickens and not some other bird?
So we had to implement this new molecular method in archaeology, which this aspect of the study was run by my colleague, Carly Peters. And she was able to look at the protein signatures of modern chickens and compare them to the protein signatures found on these eggshell fragments. And luckily, there are large databases of these protein signatures allowing us to compare them to wild birds in Central Asia. And we can confidently say that these eggshell fragments are coming from chickens.
So when you put all of that together, what did analyzing these eggshells tell you about the history of the domestic chicken?
One is it allows us to fit them into this growing picture of Central Asian prehistory and early historical period. So Central Asia is one of the key nodes on the trade routes, the Silk Road trade routes. It's also an area where empires rose and fell in early historical periods. And the chickens fit into this, so we can start to picture sedentary villages with chickens running around them at about 2,500 years ago. And by the medieval period, at about 1,000 years ago, we can start to picture big urban trading centers. So it really helps us reevaluate the image of Central Asian archaeology. But a bigger aspect of the study were the eggshell fragments and the sheer number of them and the number of contexts in the archaeological sites that they were found at. And this allows us to say for the first time that chickens were being raised not just for meat or for sport, but also for their eggs. And that probably was a key part of their rise in popularity as they spread across the ancient world.
Now, you say that you were seeing a lot more of the eggs around the medieval times. So does that tell you about how frequently chickens were laying their eggs?
The sheer numbers suggest that they're laying eggs out of season. So I think I already mentioned that the wild ancestor of the chicken, the jungle fowl, tends to only lay about 6 eggs a year. And the number of eggshells and the number of different contexts that we find these eggshells in suggests that they're being laid out of that basic season. They're not just one brood a year.
So is that suggesting that the ancient people were not actually breeding the chickens? They were just hanging on to them, collecting them?
I think we fill in an interesting piece to the puzzle here, because obviously chicken egg laying is a change in the reproductive systems of the birds. Now, obviously, in the last 100 years, directed breeding programs have changed these reproductive systems immensely in chickens. But how that actually played out in prehistory is something that we can still debate. I tend to imagine it was something that humans were not aware of or not conscious of, that simply by raising these animals in captivity, by increasing the amount of food availability that the animals had, and by removing them from predation, so they have no fear of wild predators, these processes allow them to shift evolutionarily over many, many generations, shift their reproductive systems to be more prolific in egg laying.
Just one last thing. When you crack an egg for an omelet, what goes through your mind?
What goes through my mind is the long journey that egg had to take and its ancestors of that chicken had to take to ultimately get to our dinner plates. And I think it's important to recognize the role that these Silk Road trade routes played in shaping all of our cuisines today and all the food that we have in our kitchens.
Dr. Spengler, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Robert Spengler is the head of the Archaeobotany Laboratories at the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology in Jena, Germany.
From the first fire, perhaps every light since then has been leading up to this.
We sure have come a long way since Thomas Edison developed the incandescent light bulb in 1879. It allowed us, for the first time, to use electricity to light up the night. And while incandescent lights work great, they came at a cost.
The problem is they're an absurdly inefficient light source. Around 95% of the energy they consume is turned into heat, not light. There's a better way, and don't worry, I'm not talking about fluorescent.
Today, almost every light bulb you can buy is based on LEDs, or light-emitting diodes. They're more energy-efficient, durable, and bright.
LED technology.
LED 3-pack.
With advanced LED tail lights.
With 75% less in energy costs.
And last 25 times longer. Brilliant.
But it now seems there may be a dark side to these new lights. They may come with a new kind of cost to our environment and maybe even our health. We'll start today with investigations into those concerns about the impact of LED illumination on human health. Dr. Glenn Jeffrey from University College London spent much of his career studying various aspects of eye health and vision. But lately, he's become increasingly concerned about our overall exposure to LED lighting. In a new study, he found that what LED lights are missing may be having a negative effect on how our bodies run, our basic metabolism. Dr. Jeffrey is a professor of neuroscience at UCL's Institute of Ophthalmology. Hello, and welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Oh, hello, Bob. Thank you very much.
So what is it about LED lights that concerns you the most?
Well, for billions of years, life on Earth has evolved under sunlight, and it's a very, very wide spectrum. And when we evolved into, you know, living in houses and having electricity, we had incandescent light bulbs. And they had a spectrum very similar to the sun. In the 1990s, we swapped and we started putting in LEDs. And LEDs have got a very, very restricted spectrum. And when we think about spectrum, we're not talking about just what you can see. We can talk about light like infrared light, which you can't see, but which has a big biological impact. That's all vanished in the built environment now.
So I know that a lot of LED lights sort of shine blue. So you're saying they're missing the red?
The red is completely gone from them.
Now, what about what are called warm LED lights? How much better are they?
Oh, marginal. They're a little bit better, but they just turn the blue down a bit. They don't add a lot of red.
Well, tell me about the evidence that inspired you to look into the effects of red light and what it may be doing to our metabolism.
There are a number of studies by myself and other colleagues which showed that actually just in giving people or giving animal models infrared light improved disease profiles. In insects, they live longer. And that was the kickoff point. And that kickoff point has had a trajectory now all the way into the clinic where we're doing clinical trials with people who have long, slow, progressive diseases and giving them chunks of red light.
Well, what is it about the red light that affects us? What's the mechanism there?
Okay, well, the mechanism is interesting. Every cell in your body has a series of batteries in it, and they're called mitochondria. And they literally are batteries. They've got a charge on them. And as you age or as you get diseased, the battery charge falls. Red light, it's very, very simple. It recharges the battery. It's like rechargeable batteries. You plug them in. So when we're not getting our red light, our batteries are running on a low energy profile. And that's important because those batteries determine how long you live at the end of the day.
Okay. So what does blue light do to us?
Blue light does the opposite. It discharges the battery. So it reduces the amount of energy that the mitochondria make. To put it really crudely, there's less energy sitting in your body when you want to swing your legs out of bed in the morning. If you give insects, expose them to blue light, they really slow down. They don't like it. So we've shifted our environmental light, cut out the red that was generally you can regard as good. We've got a dominance now blue, which is generally poor.
Well, tell me about your experiments, how you look specifically, how the color of light affects our metabolism.
Well, what we found really interesting was that the light regulates metabolism, and the metabolism needs glucose, needs blood sugars, because that's its petrol. That's what it runs on, that and oxygen. And so if we turned up metabolism by giving extra red light, what happened is it draws sugars and glucose out of your blood. And we sat down, we had a chat over a cup of coffee, and we said, yeah, that'll work in theory. When it did work, we were pretty dumbfounded, really dumbfounded. It reduced blood sugars very significantly. Of course, we had to do something kind of rather unpleasant. We had to get people to drink large quantities of glucose, prick their fingers every few minutes, stick a tube up their nose to look at the oxygen levels. But it was very clear when you drink a lot of glucose, your blood glucose peaks and puts you in a dangerous situation in terms of developing diabetes. If we give you a big burst of red light, we turn up your metabolism, then the mitochondria are consuming that glucose and it drags you further away from a metabolic crisis that you would have in terms of a diabetic problem.
Oh, I see. So the red light is, as you say, charging up the batteries. So the glucose gets used up like a fuel to make more energy.
Yeah.
Well, how many subjects did you have?
I think we had 30.
That's a fairly small sample.
But for statistical significance, they've all got to move in the same direction, and they all did. We didn't have one subject that didn't have a very significant drop. 25% is a pretty big change. And it was not only the fact that the peak went down in their blood glucose, the period over which the blood glucose rose went down as well. Mm-hmm. And they were producing more CO2, meaning they were burning more oxygen. It was a nice package.
Now, your subjects, I assume they were all fairly healthy people. What are the implications for people who have difficulty with blood sugar levels?
You're right. They were all healthy. And there are now a fairly significant study looking at those with established type 2 diabetes. So we did it on healthy individuals. It worked. We've done it now on a small but growing number of people with type 2 diabetes, and it's exactly the same.
Boy. So beyond its effects on metabolism and glucose levels, do you have other concerns about LED lighting?
Oh, I've got so many concerns about LED lighting. It affects your immunity. In animals, it affects lifespan. In animals, also, it affects cognition. But mitochondria and batteries are very, very heavily tied into things like dementia, into Parkinson's disease. So it's a big spectrum.
What about things like inflammation?
NASA were the first people to show in an experiment that red light protects in inflammation. They had people working under red lights, doing various tasks, and they were nicking their fingers. And they reported that wounds were healing better. And they said it helps with wound healing and reduces inflammation. And then the story dropped off. We didn't hear any more for maybe about 10 years until other people started picking it up. But definitely, there are people saying, and I think they are correct, that exposure to long wavelength red light, which goes deep into your body, I can measure some of it coming out the back, is an ideal therapy for COVID. There was a small clinical study done in Brazil, which was extremely positive, but people ignored it.
So we seem to be in kind of a conundrum here, because LED lights were introduced to save energy, which they do tremendously compared to incandescent lights. Now you're saying there's a health problem with them. So is there a way to improve LED lighting to add more red and infrared, or what can we do about this?
First thing you can do is go for a walk, walk to work, go in daylight. When you hold a leaf in bright sunlight, why is it never warm? It's cool because it reflects all the infrared light away from it. So you can get bathed in infrared light by going for a walk in the park.
Let Mother Nature take care of you.
Yeah. Well, it has done for billions of years.
So how can we confirm this as a public health issue to get more red and infrared light into our lighting systems?
Well, the science is there. The issue is, how do you change the momentum of big industry? There must be 30, 40 groups in the world now working on this, all with pretty consistent results. It is simply a matter of the major companies turning around their big machines and saying, okay, LEDs were a good idea, but we've got a problem here. I don't think they're really listening yet.
Dr. Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time.
Total pleasure. I hope to talk to you again at some point in the future.
Now we can both go take a walk. That was Dr. Glenn Jeffrey, a professor of neuroscience at University College London. Now, given how ubiquitous artificial light has become, imagine how different the nighttime would be if we weren't surrounded by so much artificial light. There'd be no glow coming from cities or small towns off in the distance, no street lights, not even the headlights of a single passing car. The only light you'd see around might be the glow of the moon. This is how life on Earth evolved for billions of years. But now, our artificial light has been polluting the environment, with significant consequences for our previously natural ecosystems. These are issues that Dr. Kevin Gaston from the University of Exeter in the UK has been investigating. He's a professor of biodiversity and conservation at the University of Exeter. Hello, and welcome to our program.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
How different is our experience of night in natural ecosystems, both with animals now, than what it would have been before the light bulb was invented?
Oh, it's been transformed over much of the landscape and increasingly much of the seascape. We've seen repeatedly, from as we've moved into space and we've taken imagery of the Earth at night, just how extensive nighttime lighting is. So it's really become a very pervasive, very extensive and growing environmental challenge.
Just an interesting anecdote. I've had a Canadian astronaut tell me that he flew in space more than once, and there were several years between his flights, and he could see a difference just looking down from the International Space Station, how cities were getting brighter and larger.
Absolutely. I mean, the pace of change really has accelerated, and it's been... Two things have happened. On the one hand, we've been introducing lighting into places where previously there was no lighting. And on the other hand, actually, we've been intensifying the lighting in places that we were already lighting. And so whilst we commonly think about that as being a sort of purely sort of urbanized phenomenon, actually, it's much, much more extensive than that.
Now, how have the new LED lights changed the whole game of artificial light?
What we've used LEDs to do is, on the one hand, broaden the spectrum of much of the lighting that we use. That's one of the consequences, and that's been a particular problem, because what we're doing in broadening the spectrum in that way is introducing more blue light into the environment, and many biological systems are very sensitive to that blue light. And the other thing that LEDs have done was that... I think there was a sort of an expectation that LED technology was commonly a lot cheaper than other kinds of lighting. and that actually it would enable us to make lots of savings on lighting. What actually has happened is we've tended to spend just as much money on lighting, but LED lighting has enabled us to provide yet more lighting for the same funds. So actually, the introduction of LEDs has been also associated with an increase in the availability of lighting.
So how widespread then are the effects of light pollution on natural ecosystems?
So almost every week, people are reporting the impacts of artificial lighting on yet another biological system has been discovered. So from plants, to microbes, up to mammals, the whole spectrum of organisms, and from sort of the level of the gene up to a whole ecosystems. It really is a very profound impact.
Mm-hmm. You say whole ecosystems. I mean, it's not just the individual animals, but how can it affect how an entire ecosystem could work?
Well, because the effects sort of ramify up and down food webs. So if artificial light is impacting the plants, for example, by changing the time when they're budding out leaves or they're flowering, that has impacts on the organisms which are feeding on the plants or pollinating the plants. That then has implications on the things that feed on those insects. And then those organisms themselves are being impacted. So, and that feeds back down those chains.
Well, let's look at some specific examples in these ecosystems. For example, how is light pollution affecting predator-prey relationships?
So that's one of these examples of these flows back and forth. So artificial lighting can impact the prey themselves in terms of their activity times, let's say. That might impact their reproduction, their mortality, their death rates. And equally, the predators that are feeding on them, it will change their behavior. It will change their mortality, their reproductive rates. So there are complex interactions back and forth.
Can you give me some examples?
Work we've been doing actually asking if you change the lightscapes in which organisms are living, so the light environments that they're living at night, so you're brightening that up, how do potential prey species actually respond to predators? Does it make them more nervous, less nervous? Can they see predators potentially coming over longer distances? Does that mean that they're kind of happier, or do they move off feed? And we've been showing how those impacts actually change the feeding behaviors of shorebirds, which are, you know, feeling vulnerable at night to particular kinds of predators.
Oh, I see. The lighting just makes them more visible to the predator.
Well, on the one hand, it makes them more visible to the predator. On the other hand, they might be able to see the predator much better.
Now, a lot of animals are nocturnal. How would artificial light affect how species get around at night?
Organisms that are naturally using the nighttime, they're going to try and avoid areas of light. Typically, you're reducing the amount of living space they have. Some organisms will be drawn to the light, and that will have impact, other kinds of impacts on their movements. Classically, of course, we all know about moths being drawn to light. And so you could argue that in areas which are sort of a mix of lit and unlit areas, you're just fundamentally shifting how organisms are moving around. It would be the equivalent of us losing daylight during the daytime.
So in what ways can light pollution affect the actual biological processes in wildlife species?
Yeah, so I think you have to think about this as being something very systemic. So, I mean, there's evidence that it influences which genes are being expressed, because some of those are dependent upon the environments, the light environments in which organisms are operating. It affects their physiology, their metabolism, maybe their growth. It can affect their likelihood and the success of reproduction. It can affect their mortality. And then how that feeds through to ecosystem cycles, carbon cycles and nitrogen cycles, and all the way through. Mm-hmm.
So how difficult would it be to reduce the environmental impacts of light pollution?
I think if we started thinking very explicitly that what we were wanting to do was ensure that we only had light where we needed it, when we needed it, and in the form that we needed it, and so we weren't pushing light out into the wider landscape unnecessarily, and typically at some cost to ourselves, economically if nothing else, then that alone would start to limit the problem. And then if we think more carefully about how we shield lights and the spectrum, the colour of the lights that we use, there's lots of things we could do, and we could potentially do those very quickly and with potentially some economic benefit.
Dr. Gaston, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Kevin Gaston is a professor of biodiversity and conservation at the University of Exeter in the UK. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks was produced by Olsi Sorokina, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.